Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I tell untold stories and provide people with an alternative narrative to what they hear on mainstream media. Exploration in 21st centuries is about storytelling. It's about documenting and disseminating facts that provide people better understanding of the world out there.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and our latest episode with Reza Pakravan. Reza is an explorer, filmmaker, and writer. His documentaries, talks, and books have taken audiences on journeys to some of the most remote corners of the world. He's presented and produced primetime TV series aired worldwide on the BBC, Channel 4, Al Jazeera, and Amazon Prime. He recently became the first person in modern history to have traveled the full length of Africa, from west to east via the Sahel region. He's also crossed the Sahara by bike and then decided he'd cycle the 11,000-mile length of the planet from north to south in a record time of 102 days. But he wasn't always into mad adventures and comes from a corporate 9-to-5 background. In this episode, we discuss the transition, as well as the commercialization of adventure and the line between authenticity and adventure. We also touch on world records and where people find power in them, and the difference between an explorer and an adventurer. Okay. Over to Reza Pakravan.
It would be good to just start, I think, by giving me some background on who you are and what you do, and maybe a bit of information about whether or not you've always done this. Have you always been an adventurer, in inverted commas?
Interesting question. I'm a producer and an explorer, and I specifically call myself an explorer because I always bring things back from my expeditions. I bring information back that are beneficial to sort of an outside audience, the people that haven't been there. So hopefully they get a better idea of the world that they haven't been exposed to. So that's the role of an explorer. And I make films, mainly anthropological television series, maybe many television series about the remote communities, about indigenous people around the world, which normally requires a prolonged period of travel. So that's what I do. I was giving talk before the pandemic, but that's at the moment that's taking a back seat. And no one gives talks. That's sort of my sort of a day-to-day job. Your question is, no, I have not been an explorer all my life. I start my career in a business world. I come from a television background. My mum and dad worked in television all their lives. But when I got to the stage that I had to choose a career for myself, although for me the path was paved to go to television because I knew all about it. I grew up in the family of my mum, dad working as a director, mom as a producer. I grew up on set, you know, after nursery, you know, I was taken to the set, you know, sit down there quiet. I knew all about it, but I saw my mom and dad work really hard for little money, day and night. And I quite never got it. I thought, wow, this is so labor intensive for, you know, not much money. And I thought, I know better. I'll go and, you know, enter the world of business. And I went to business school, studied finance, went to the City of London. And 10 years later, I was, you know, for 10 years of that wore suit and tie and commute to the city and got, you know, money was really good, but got to the stage that, wow, I couldn't do it anymore. I was going crazy because it was against my nature. And I made a decision. I combined two passion of my life, which was traveling and adventure with filmmaking, which I had the skills. I went to the film school. Learn a craft from scratch, combine it with my previous knowledge, and started exploring and making films.
Ace, what was the first kind of jump into the swimming pool? What was the first journey?
Started in Madagascar. I mean, the trigger point was in Madagascar. So, you know, after years of, you know, being in sort of a corporate world, going to these like holidays and stuff like that, I just needed to do something different. I just needed to clear my head. So I signed up for a voluntary trip to Madagascar, the school building trip. So I took a month off. I combined all my holidays. So I went to Madagascar and did manual work like shoveling, mixing cements and stuff like that, carpentering. A month in a bush in Madagascar gave me a really good clean space to think. No emails, no phone, no nothing. I just, the simplicity of life and the charm there really triggered something in me. And when I got back, I thought, nope, there's a bigger world, bigger picture out there, and I want to explore it. I want to be part of it. I want to live it. Just don't want to go on holidays. I just want to make this my job. So when I got back, I thought of, I didn't have any skills. I didn't have a great, you know, I didn't have a great physique or incredible genetic makeup, or I wasn't the strongest. So I thought I need to learn things. You know, the only skill I had, I could cycle. So I looked around the house. I found a little bicycle and went out and started riding it. So sort of a morning ride turned to a full day ride. Then little by little combined those with weekend camping. I could make a weekend out of it. And went to the first like a journey was for me to go to Nepal and you know, cycle the Annapurna circuit. I was quite good at mountain biking, so I thought, well, this is a trekking route. I want to go with a mountain bike. And I did it. Got back, got built up some confidence, and it was time to take the next step. I trained and trained and trained, and I realized, actually, no one has crossed the Sahara Desert on a bicycle. So I applied for sort of a Guinness World Record and went and did it and got the world record, and it was exciting. Now it sounds so far away, you know, it's so different to what I do, but you know, those days for me was, I thought, to establish myself, to just, you know, have something to say, I've got to break world records. So that's what I did.
And I mean, that opens up a lot of questions, but what, forgive my naivety, but it sounds like it would be very difficult to cycle across the Sahara Desert. you know, with the sand and the dunes and obviously the heat.
Yeah. It was quite difficult. But obviously it's not the Sahara Desert. It's not only sand dunes. You know, it's pretty much rugged, corrugated sand. Not all of it is a soft sand. So I could maneuver around, the dunes. And, you know, whenever I had no choice, I had to just carry my bicycle over the dunes. It was, a lot of pushing, a lot of, grunting involved. But, yeah, I managed to make it. I had a really good guide.
Was it fun?
It was. In fact, it was. It was, it's kind of, if you're a cyclist, you gotta be a student of pain. Someone told me that. And it was painful, but it was liberating because it was my first, sort of a statement to say, hey, I'm here. You know, I can do this. You know, from a day to day corporate, you know, turning up, at 8 a.m., leave at, you know, 6 p.m., 7 p.m. every day, doing the same job over and over again, and hating it. All of a sudden, I was in the Sahara Desert. I was doing an expedition that has never been done before. So that was really powerful. For personally, I don't know, for outside world, I didn't care really. But personally, for me, it was so important, was so liberating. And it was a personal test. It was a test of endurance. There was a test of my skills. And it was for me to say, okay, am I ready to take the next step? You know, it wasn't like, I'm going to resign my job and, you know, go to Africa and see an elephant and say life is beautiful. It wasn't like that. I wanted to make a career out of it. I just didn't want to just leave my job and then, you know, spend all my money, go back to it again and say, oh, well, you know, it was a hobby. No, I wanted to make it a career. And it was interesting. A director, a friend of mine, gave me a camera and I went and shot myself most of the time. And he joined me for the last 2 days. So he put something together and that made a little reportage in BBC World. They picked it up. I couldn't believe actually that happened completely by luck. And that was my first sort of a lead in to the sort of TV world.
Yeah. And it's almost an easy question, but what next?
So I got back from the Sahara Desert, full of excitement, and the confidence level has gone to another, confidence has gone to another level. I thought, okay, maybe I'm good at cycling from north to south. I did it north to south, length of Sahara Desert. Maybe now I can do a bigger north to south journey. So what if I take my bicycle to the northernmost point in Europe and cycle to the southernmost point in Africa and try to do it as fast as possible so I can break another world record. I can sort of market it in a way so I can get a sponsorship and some press behind it. And that was a time that my decision was to, okay, I'm ready to take the next step. This is it. I'm doing this trip and I'm going to call myself an adventurer and I'm going to leave the corporate world. And this is the trip that I'll make it commercially successful. And this is a trip that I'm going to make a career out of it. So, trained for it about 18 months from an overweight office worker, got myself to the stage that I was ready to take these 11,000 miles. And the Guinness World Record said you have to do it in 100 days. And yeah, I started the journey and I didn't do it in 100 days. It took me 102 days. Because I got malaria, I got really nasty food poisoning, but it made a really good documentary television series. Lots of drama, you know, good cliffhangers, if you like. You know, you're having a malaria, you know, in some random clinic in the middle of Kenya, or a cockroach infested a clinic. And then that's a really good cliffhanger for your one of your episodes in a documentary. So that was really successful. Yes, I didn't make the record, but that was a really good start of my career.
How much do you care that you didn't get a record, honestly?
At the time, the world collapsed when I got malaria. I was so upset, man. It's just but I processed it as I headed south to sort of to the end of my journey. I sort of write it out, and I the more I started thinking about it, the more I realized actually the purpose, the record was nothing. It wasn't that important. The record was, I got so obsessed with the record, but the record was only a marketing thing for me. It was just to put it in front of the sponsors, to put it, to get a television behind it, to just, you know, telling people, yeah, I'm breaking the world record. But the purpose was actually the journey and writing a book and making a television series about it. That was the first time actually I could put my, I was straight out of the film school, and it was the first time that I actually could put my skills into practice. I had a camera crew joining me in two different part of the journey. And the most of the stuff I was narrating myself. I was filming it myself with my friend. So it was all, you know, part of, you know, making this television series, you know, telling that story and write a book about it. So the record wasn't that important, but it became obsession. It became a big obsession for me that I was chasing miles day in, day out, every night, you know, riding through the night till I hit the daily target.
And it's really interesting because I've spoken to a lot of people from a lot of different walks of life, but you're very, very honest about the fact that some of these things you're doing for commercial purposes, which like lots of people are doing. You know, it's the whole, how do we fund adventure in the 21st century? And there's a reality to that. We can either save up, or we can go on really cheap journeys, or we can turn it into a business. Do you go on? Sorry.
Sorry, I just wanted to say there is absolutely no novelty, or there's no pride in being poor. You know, I'm not interested of being poor and having really cool adventures. There's absolutely I can see why an adventurer has to be a poor person. That's a really bad perception that, you know, people of our industry just keep. I mean, yeah, I can understand, you know, at the beginning you have to save up to, you know, start your adventures. But if you call yourself an adventurer, why not making money out of it? And of course, lots of my peers, they are making money. You know, they give really good talks and, you know, make, you know, they host television series and stuff like that. And there is, there's no problem. I can't see any problem with that. Why not? Why not making good money out of what you do? You can sustain it for longer, you know?
Yeah. And I suppose the thing for me is always, and it's really simple, is it authentic? And that, you know, I just come back to that every time. I think, you know, we talked a little bit beforehand, but if these journeys are real, then that's okay. If, you know, personally, I think if we get into territory where Bear Grylls is abseiling off antlers on the Isle of Skye, I think, you know, that's a different type of adventure documentary. It's entertainment rather than documentary. Where do you draw the line?
Indeed. That's a very interesting discussion, I have to say. Bear Grylls is a television star. He's an entertainer, a very respectable person. I mean, what he does, he cannot deny the skills of that man. He's got so much skills, he's got so much experience, he doesn't need to prove anything. The stuff that he does, of course, I can't do that sort of shit. Yes, there is a sensationalism behind it that makes it really watchable. I would much rather to watch Bear Grylls than an adventurer sitting on a bicycle or in the middle of a desert to say, oh yeah, I'm tired, I'm hungry, walk with no story is so boring. If you want to have an authentic adventure, fine. I'm 100% there. I'm supporting you. I'm behind it. But that's different to a television narrative. It's different to a television program. In a television program, the most important thing is you're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for the audience. You have to entertain the audience who are watching it. You are getting their time. So you have to inform them. You have to entertain them. And you have to give something to them to watch. You know, if it's only about you, then good luck to you. Have a great adventure. So where I draw the line is basically I do a lot of I make television not all the time put myself in front of a camera. I only put myself in front of a camera in expeditions that is so close to my heart. That's why it takes them such a long time to get them off the ground. Normally, I mean, my last expedition took me 2 years to get it off the ground. Because I had to do so much research to be able to inform people. B, I'm wanting to make it as authentic as possible, travel as a local dude, have those hardship, sort of things are very important for me. 3, I need to get something behind it to believe in that vision. Hence, it was taking that long to get it off the ground. It takes so long to make it. Not all the commissioners are interested in, making television of someone who's on the road for 4 or 5 months. They want it really snappy, very short. So these are the obstacles I have to face to get my own content, my own television programs off the ground. So hence, that authenticity is very important for me. But the stuff that I make about other people, that entertainment comes first, And obviously, if there is a body of information that I can bring to it, of course I will. But, that's just, make it and give it to the client. But this is just, my heart is in it. Did that answer your question?
Yes, I did. It's interesting because I could talk about that all day because it's obviously quite close to my heart as well,
Yeah, you're doing it, of course.
But it's just the line between authenticity and kind of reality and entertainment, because even authentic stories, we have to tell them in a way that's interesting. Exactly as you say, something that really resonated with me is you can't just watch somebody sit on a bike saying how hard it is for an hour. Nobody's going to watch that. The hard thing, I suppose, in the line of work that we do is you need jeopardy, but equally you don't always want jeopardy, because if you're on expedition, you want things to be as safe as possible and as peaceful as possible and as enjoyable as possible. But I guess that's you've clearly made some very clever decisions about where you go, what you do, and how you can guarantee a sense of jeopardy with, well, maybe not in your case guaranteeing you'll come home, but certainly, finding that fine line between safety and risk, which I suppose brings us very neatly onto, traveling 5,000 miles across Africa.
This was my perhaps most important expedition that I did in my life. Obviously, the expedition that is very close to my heart. This is the best piece of work I've ever produced. Really, really proud of it. And when I saw the people's reaction to the television series, I realized, oh, I got this one right. And I'm extremely proud of it. I spent so much time in it, especially, when you're traveling to war zones. Foreign Office read. All the countries that I traveled, apart from Senegal and Ethiopia, everything was red zones. None of them advice against all travels. I needed to find a way to do this in an unbroken line, you know, just get through these borders. All borders are closed. One day one opens, another day it's shut. Incredibly difficult logistics, incredibly difficult locations to travel to. One day you have to dodge Boko Haram, another day Al-Qaeda, war breaks, tribal wars, conflict, all that kind of stuff across the Sahelian belt in Africa. One of the reasons that it took such a long time to put it together was I needed to find a network of individuals that helped me to get through. And part of that for me was to go to Chad, which was the black hole in this, the whole thing, because no one knows anything about Chad. If you go to Royal Geographical Society, talk to people about Chad, all these well-traveled people, all these gritty adventurers, no one knows anything about Chad. No one knows anything about Niger. No one, a little bit know about Mali. But these are the black holes in that information is completely lost. You know, people haven't traveled there much. So, and I was going to places that they are completely off the map. They're sort of uncharted territories. And they've been subject to years of wars. That's why people don't know anything about it, because these places have been war zones. No one traveled there over past, three, four decades. I managed to get a piece of work from Oxfam and went there with them so they could provide sort of a logistics. And I did a bit of a recce in Chad, found a really good guide who sort of introduced me to other people who could get me through. So, yeah, put the piece of the puzzle together, but it was so difficult to connect these countries and find the way to cross from east to from west to east.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what was the specific objective and where did the idea come from?
So the series is called The World's Most Dangerous Borders. When I looked at the Sahelian belt, I realized there are so many untold stories that no one told it. Mainstream media focuses on war, terrorism, drought, mass migration to Europe, all that kind of stuff. And going back to the definition of being an explorer, I tell untold stories and provide people with an alternative narrative to what they hear on mainstream media. Exploration in 21st centuries is about storytelling. It's about documenting and disseminating facts that provide people better understanding of the world out there. And that was my job. And I heard my sort of calling and said, well, these countries they've been completely closed to outsiders. And this is my job to go and tell the story of these countries. And what do they share? These borders, their borders are home to military battlegrounds and displaced families. And along those borders are incredible tribes, really, really untouched, really. They haven't been filmed. These stories haven't been told. Incredible cultures, incredible traditions live along those borders. So you have the war and jeopardy and all that kind of stuff. You have the terrorism, you have migration, and you have this incredible anthropological piece. How can you bring all of these together and tell those stories? So the border was the key to bring me there. That was a common thread that connecting all these little narratives together. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. I mean, to be honest, I just would love for you to tell me the story of how you traveled, across that line.
I started pitching the idea to sort of broadcast it. Finally, I managed to get funding behind it, and someone was mad enough to, you know, go with my idea, put a team together, and started in Senegal. There are no foreigners along this. You hardly see a foreigner walking around the streets of Mali, or especially now, or Chad or Niger, apart from aid workers, apart from the humanitarian people, or army personnel. So effectively, I and normally they move from trouble to trouble. They move to conflict to another conflict. They go to somewhere that's solving people's problem. Hugely respectable. I didn't want to move from conflict to conflict. I wanted to go from story to another story. And the best way to tell the story is to make yourself vulnerable. I didn't want to travel with a Jeep in an air conditioned Jeep. Or 4x4 while people are traveling in animal cart. How can I tell their story? I need to make myself vulnerable. So I traveled as they did, eating the same food from the same bowl as they did, participated in the same rituals, in the same, I slept in the same houses. I got involved in their traditions, sometimes really scary. I got initiated, I got burned, you know, all that kind of stuff that you can sort of watch it on. It's out there now. And it was interesting. So that's how I managed to tell those stories, get really close to people. And having a great guide with me, that was the key to opening, unlocking all those stories, you know. He was integral to the success of the expedition.
Yeah, I was going to ask this question later, but, you know, let's go there now. How important, I mean, you've said they're very important, but why are guides and fixers so important? And what are their responsibilities?
A good guide is your eyes and ears on the ground. They know the local language. They know the local custom. They know how to open doors. For example, I give you a very tangible example. Afar people they live in Danakil Depression in Ethiopia, the hottest place on earth. They're very hard people. They are very difficult people to talk to. They don't like outsiders. They don't even like Ethiopians. You know, they just like Afar, and that's why their culture has remained really intact. They don't allow foreigners to come to their village. So my guide knew their traditions really well. So when we enter our village, we went to the village elder. The first thing he said, once you shake hand with the guy, bring his hand like this close to you and kiss his hand, and then he will kiss your hands back. So that's what I did. I brought his hand close to my face, kissed it, and then he grabbed my hand back to his mouth and he gave me a kiss in my hand. And that immediately opened the door. And all of a sudden, we were sort of accepted because, you know, all of a sudden you target them from, you connect them with a cultural level that they don't expect. And that's, you know, that's a simple example. And so on, you know, across the Sahel, you know, there were numerous occasions. I mean, apart from translation, apart from knowing the local language, knowing those little customs, they were absolutely incredible. They just opened door after door.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
how much of it for you is about the human experience versus traveling across a landscape?
Human experience for me is 100%. I love incredible places. I love climbing. I love, walking. I love, physical endurance. Absolutely lovely. But without human story, for me, that makes no sense. I love natural beauty, but for me, it's more important to see the lives of people who call that landscape their home. How do they survive there? How do they adapt to that sort of a landscape? So human connection, telling human story for me is everything. Telling the lives of the indigenous people. Of course, they live in harmony with the nature within that environment. So, connecting the two has been always for me the most important thing. And in my sort of this television series, I try to tell the story of, going behind the headline and tell, while the world media focuses on, mass migration or terrorism, what is the root of all of that? And, when you dig really deep, you realize they're all climate related. And that brings all the story together. So for example, along the Sahelian belt, when the media says, 70 people got drowned in, Mediterranean Sea, or, there has been a mass migration or war broke. What is the reason behind it? The journalists go there, spend 3-4 days there, and report on war. And fly back home and tell the story of war. But no one actually tells the story of people and that landscape. And that was my job, to tell that story. That was my focus. So, and the story was, because of the global warming and subsequent desertification, the desert has pushed the communities from the north of the Sahara Desert, north of the Sahel, towards further south. And that put a huge amount of pressure on the people in the south, who their resources were already dwindling. And sort of those guys from the north came to their lands with their cattle, with their animals, and they're using the same resources as these guys. And obviously that causes conflict. Fueling those conflicts are terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, promoting radicalism and creating those wars. And that creates mass murder, and that creates migration, and that migration leads to, people getting drowned in the Mediterranean Sea and all that kind of stuff. So that's how you connect the dots. And the only way to do this is to spend time to really embed yourself in the lives of people who call the Sahel their home. So that was my job.
And how long did you spend on that trip?
4 months.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you get embedded.
4 months plus 2 years of research plus a month in Chad.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, this is, I'm wary of not going too dark with it all, but those issues that you've just been talking about, they're not going to get better before they get worse, are they?
No. But if you have information about it, I mean, obviously this is quite a dark story, but there are lots of positives to it as well, but, as I said, my job is to highlight all negative and positive and, bring those stories to life. Let's talk about a positive. I came across an incredible initiative across the Sahelian belt. The eight nations have come together to grow a wall of trees. They call it Great Green Wall, to stop the desertification and bring life back to the Sahel. So they're planting trees like a wall to stop the desert coming forward. Absolutely incredible multinational effort, and it's fascinating how local communities are invested in it. They're all into it big time. So super interesting. And hopefully, you know, once that wall is there, the prosperity will go back to those communities.
Yeah. And so again, it's heavy, but are you hopeful that this will all play out well in this part of the world?
Yeah, definitely. That's the key. That's the way forward, put it this way. Addressing issues from sort of a really, from the root. Sorry, I'm sort of deviated to this sort of a dark space from the adventure, put it this way. This is an adventure podcast, so let's go back to adventure.
Well, no, I really like it. I mean, that's the thing. You know, as things have changed over the years, adventure's relative, right? And adventure's subjective, and it's not all about suffering on bicycles. It's, you know, I mean, frontline surgeons working in Syria are living an adventurous lifestyle. Adventure, it's interesting you say this is the specifics of what an explorer is, because adventure is the same thing, you know, adventure is all relative. But yeah, maybe it's a bit dark for 8 o'clock on a, you know, Thursday morning. I'm about to make it loads worse though, but no, we'll break the fourth wall, you know. So I'm sat here with my filmmaker hat on thinking, okay, yeah, but there must have been loads of jeopardy on that route as well. Obviously we've spoken about finding the jeopardy in projects, but it didn't always go well, right?
No, it went wrong all the time, so many times. The first wake-up call was when I went to, my route was, I was following the Niger River, absolutely incredible river, so much beauty and culture around it. I was following this nomadic fishermen tribes called Bozo. And they're basically, because there's so much insurgency around that area, I chose waterways to draw less attention to myself. And obviously there was so much to explore around those waterways. I mean, Niger River has been facilitating mobilization of various West African civilizations for centuries. And it was an incredible story to tell. So I followed, and I realized actually Bozos is their migration time. And they go to the headwater, they go further down. They travel where the fish are. So I followed them downstream towards Timbuktu. My goal was to get to Timbuktu, but by the time I got to halfway through Mali, my guide said, I cannot go any further. This is too dangerous. And I said, man, what do you mean too dangerous? And he's local. And when he says it's dangerous, you think twice. So I thought, okay, let's not go with a boat. I left Bozo's and I went and asked a 4x4 to try to charter a 4x4 to take me to Timbuktu. And not a single person, not even for a large sum of money, was willing to take me to Timbuktu. They said, you are a target. As soon as they see you, they're going to kill you. They're going to kidnap you and they're going to kill me. So I like my life. Bugger off. No one was willing to take me to Timbuktu, and you know, I wanted to live. I decided not to go to Timbuktu. That pushed me I had to change my route, and that pushed me to the Dogon country, which is another area of conflict. This is incredible land that occupied by the Dogon tribe. Have you ever heard of Dogon?
No.
It's an ancient tribe, one of the most extraordinary tribes in Africa, that they are animist. They believe in the spirit that animates the universe. So it pushed me to their land, and now they are in conflict with, so they are effectively, they don't believe in modern religion, but they're in conflict with another tribe called Fulanis. So I stepped into this conflict because I had nowhere else to go. That was the only way through. So I hired a Dogon guide, and he took me to to the Dogon country, and I've seen extraordinary. I stepped into the world that I never ever expected. It was like going back by hundreds of years. It was absolutely incredible. People live in houses that you wouldn't even dream of. It was so picturesque. It was so beautiful. It was a way of life that has not changed for millennia. Everything was going well. But one day I woke up and I was told 20 miles away, 150 members of the Dogon tribe were slaughtered by the Fulanis and the war broke out. Just get yourself out of there. It's not a place to sort of hang about. All the roads from and to Dogon countries were closed. So we had to hire a couple of donkeys and travel through a really, really dangerous road, a mountainous road, to get ourselves out of there. One of the donkeys died, fell into the valley with some of our tents and stuff. It was so dangerous, the road. And, I'm not an sort of an expert mountaineer. It was scary. Finally, we got ourselves out of the conflict zone. But that was a close call.
God, I didn't know that story. That's mad. I suppose I don't know. What's really interesting for me is that the perception, maybe this is just my perception, my bias, and I need to change that, is that, producing adventure television, a lot of the time, there's a lot of, actually we're only 2 miles away from the town, or, it's all for the camera. But the reality is, not always the case, right?
Yeah, that's right. Especially when you're, vulnerable in those sort of locations. And I quite like it, I have to say. When I come back, when you've been exposed to that level of extreme, sometimes normality feels a bit boring, especially now. During that trip, I basically dodged many difficult situation, but I got caught in one of them. I was put in prison for 4 days in Darfur. Before I get to the border of Sudan, I had all the permission by the Sudanese government to go and meet these Darfurian tribes called Masalit. Absolutely incredible tribe. And, because Darfur has been closed for so many years, there hasn't been any camera there. There hasn't been any journalist gone there. And this tribe has remained untouched. Their story has never been told. I was so proud that I'm going to get there. I'm going to be that explorer that's going to tell the stories. And because we were in such remote corner of the world, we didn't know what was going on inside Sudan. The revolution was happening inside Sudan. The old dictator got toppled, and we stepped into Sudan, got arrested right at the border, were sent to the military barracks, and then handed over to Sudanese intelligence and questioned. And for 4 days they kept us, and then after 4 days they kicked us out of Darfur. And that was quite a dark moment, I have to say.
Yeah, how were you treated?
Well, what can you do? Just telling your sitting in a little room and count the moment to get out.
Did you think it was all going to be okay?
No. I knew at the end of the day, the Foreign Office will come and get me, but I didn't know how long it's going to take. I might have been, I might just stay there for a long time. I didn't know when I'm going to get out.
It's a cliche question, but you're a father now, right? How do you justify the risk?
I don't know yet, to be find out, because when I did that, my wife was pregnant, and I'm sitting in Darfur in a bloody prison cell, waiting to be released. I think my wife is, can tolerate a fair amount of risk. You know, she's quite used to me being away. Now, I don't know. I really don't know yet to be tested.
Do you think you'll rein it in, or do you think?
I don't know. What I did this time in terms of risk, that was my limit. I think you know your limit at some point, and I definitely hit my limit, because you know I really stretched myself to some really, really dangerous situations. Maybe sometimes irresponsible, but I was so hungry to tell that stories. I don't think I would be willing to take those sort of risks anymore. Definitely will take the sort of physical risks, but because I'm in control of, you know, if I'm on top of the rock, you know, I know that I have a harness, you know, there's a calculated risk. But you know, going to the R4, I'm giving myself in the hand of someone else that, you know, I'm not in control of, you know, I cannot control that risk. So I will, yes, to answer your question, yes, I will take risks that I'm in control of. How can I control them?
It's a very interesting point, because I completely agree with you. I think the risk in the mountains, the risk in, you know, deserts, etc., when you're totally the master of your own kingdom, you're responsible for every move you make. And so you can make a calculated risk for every single step. Obviously, sometimes it doesn't go well. We all know that. But I always feel like the human risk, like the third party human risk, is a totally different thing. You just kind of walk up to the border checkpoint and you roll the dice, right?
100%. You know, your destiny, you know, is in the hand of someone else. You know, in Niger, in Mali, you know, they just, it was really crazy. I'm just looking back, you know, the places that we went, you know, my guide now tells me, man, you're crazy. I mean, what was going on in your head that you decided to go to those places? I'm not willing to do that ever again. That was definitely my limit.
Did you feel any sense of responsibility around the other people with you?
The guilt, towards the end of the journey, once we were in Somalia, I was climbing this mountain, and then that was the last obstacle before we get to the end, and the end was the Red Sea. While I was climbing that mountain, I was just looking behind, and I was thinking, for the first time in 4 months, I feel relaxed. I feel I can just let go. My guards are down, and the guilt started to creep in, and I realize, oh God, I had a pregnant wife at home, my cameraman, my guide, my, you know, the other part of the crew. I risked so much, and fortunately, we were all safe. You know, at that moment of time, I thought, okay, this is calculated, but in fact, some of the times wasn't. It was like completely sort of driven by myself, because I was so hungry to tell that story and I drag people to those places.
I mean, you've sort of answered this question, but I'm interested, you know, what is it that motivates you now, rather than like the extrinsic, you know, values? What is it that keeps you wanting to move forward and inspires you?
Storytelling, you know, that's what I'm hungry for, and that's what I absolutely love. You know, you have an idea, you know, you scribble it on a piece of paper, and then that turns to a book, that turns to a television series. You know, you put it together. You know, the job of explorers are entrepreneurs, effectively. You know, look, to get an expedition off the ground, you need to have money, you need to have a team, put it together, you need to create audience, You have to find a platform to tell that story. So all these elements, if you put them together, you can really see the parallel in the life of an entrepreneur. You know, what do? They create a product, they put a team together, they bring ideas together, people with different expertise, and bring that idea to life. That's what we do. You know, we, I need to find the right cameraman, I need to find the right sound man, I need to find the right guide, logistics, I need to learn the particular skills that I don't know. If I'm going canoeing, you know, I need to throw myself into that and master canoeing or climbing or whatever I have to do, or whatever the expedition requires me to do. Then you got to find a platform, which is like a television or book, or, you know, get some money behind it, you know, find brands, find, you know, broadcaster who really believe in your vision, go through all those sort of a risk assessment, all that kind of stuff. So it's just, you know, bringing the whole thing together, get the expedition off the ground, go and do it, come back and create that story and share it with the outside world. And perhaps going back to your question, what makes you sort of motivated to do sort of more is that added value to people's life is when, you know, someone emails me and say, man, I learned a lot from this expedition. It wasn't just a television series. It was something that, you know, you opened my eyes into the world that I didn't know anything about it. And that for me, it's so heartwarming. It's so important, you know, that difference that I can make in people's life and, you know, inform people. And obviously there is definitely a personal gain into this. You know, when I go and see these incredible people, when I go and, you know, live their lives, and, you know, it's such a privilege to be able to travel like this. You know, imagine if you travel, just go and see, you know, it doesn't, you know, the camera enabled me being in front of a camera or having, you know, going to places with a camera enabled me to get the snapshot of someone's life at a tribe or an indigenous community that it just gives a different angle to how to enter people's life.
And you speak really passionately about it, obviously, but you started out on this journey, as in this career, loving adventure, and adventure was something that you were transfixed by. Has making it your career in your profession taken away from your own adventure and your own experience?
I was doing adventure for the sake of adventure, and I called myself an adventurer. So I was cycling fast, I was climbing, I was, doing all sorts of physical endurance, mega journeys and all that kind of stuff. And I was an adventurer. I was an adventurer and I wasn't bringing anything back. I was chasing personal goals. But now I'm an explorer. That there is a distinct definition here. Is my job to bring things back rather than actually pursuing. My personal goals now taking the back seat. The informing people, bringing information and sharing with outside world, that is my job. Whether that's an article, whether that's in a moving picture format, that is my job. That's what I get paid to do. So I look at it as a job. And yeah, in that sort of a pure form of, you know, me and versus element, it has changed, you know. Not sure how to refer to that sort of a purity. But yeah, perhaps, you know, I think I know your question, you know, if you go to a, if you experience a hardship or if you're in somewhere remote and if you have a camera there or if you don't have a camera there, how would you describe it? What's the difference? Is that your question, isn't it?
It was about to be my next question, so feel free.
definitely it makes a difference, because I need to think about how to put the story together and whether that story makes sense or not. A lot of time happens that you naturally fall into that. I'll give you an example. I was in danical depression, and it happened that, you know, we ran out of water in the hottest place in the world. I lost my guide, and I told him, like, I want to take some drone shots, go to the car, and I know where I came from. I can find myself, find my way. Flew the drone with my cameraman and was ready to go back to the car. I sort of followed the direction, and I had a camera with me. Just realized, fuck, everywhere look exactly the same. There's no way I can find my direction. I could not. I mean, and it was 11. It was 12 o'clock, so the sun was right above us. I mean, 50 degrees centigrade. You have this much water left, just less than a liter, and that went really quickly. So I ran out of water. Obviously, if I didn't have a camera, all I was thinking was like, go, and find the way to survive, to find a car. But obviously, having a camera on board, I pretty took advantage of the situation. Not only I was searching for the car, also I was describing the situation to the camera and made a survival situation. But that was a genuine survival situation. Until they managed to, they went to the nearest village. They got, I don't know, 50 Afar people to come and find us in the middle of a desert, completely lost in the last drop of water. So that was the closest example that I can sort of tell you. But, you know, that made a really good story. It was formed, you know, part of our story. And it was a genuine situation.
I think, you know, for me, it just comes down to, it's so easy to get bogged down in the nuance of, is this adventure, is this exploration, is it authentic, et cetera, et cetera. But right at the core of it, I think, like listening to you speak about it, right at the core of it, if you're enjoying it and it feels adventurous and it's raising the heart rate, then what's the problem?
I can't see any problem with that.
No. Do you still enjoy adventure for the sake of adventure?
I do. When I'm on my own or with my mate, going climb the mountain, or you know, that's the adventure is my hobby. It's my you know, it's something that I really enjoy doing. You know, you know, wander off to the Alps and climb the mountain. That's my holiday. That's something I really enjoy. It's not something, you know, earning me any money. That's not the profession. But, you know, definitely exploration is my profession.
Ace, okay. I have two last questions for you.
Go on, then.
What worries you?
What worries me? In life or while I'm out there?
Whatever you want.
Interesting. Many things. To be honest, sometimes finances. Because I'm a dad now, so I have to, you know, provide for my family, for my kid. I'm always worried about my career, because I don't want to get complacent, you know. Although, you know, now my sometimes is sort of a masochism, because, you know, my series is done so well now, but I'm worried because, you know, what's next? What's next is always worries me, keeps me awake at night. You know, yeah, same as you. I'm pretty sure you're sort of experiencing it. You know, okay, this television series is done. What's next? You know, how tell another story. And it's not really easy to just find an untold story to tell, you know. It's very difficult. These are the things that I constantly... And you know, perhaps my insecurity makes me try harder. And I kind of like it. I come to terms with it. I'm really insecure about my career. And I think that allows me to try, you know, harder. I enjoy working really hard, but there's always something in the back of my mind to do more, to make something better.
I think that's very human. I don't think, well, I can relate. I'm sure lots of people can relate. What brings you hope?
Seeing people that go out of their way to help others. That definitely restore my faith in humanity. And when I see people in sort of a really selfless people out there in some of the most remote corners of the world, and they're just out there to help others, to help people that they really need help, to give voice to people that otherwise their voice won't be heard. That really warms my heart and makes me think, there are really lovely people out there.
Nice. If people do want to watch the series and read the books, where do they go?
Oh, sure. I have two television series now on Amazon Prime. One is called The World's Most Dangerous Borders, which is the latest one that we spend most of the time discussing it right now. That's on Amazon Prime. And I have another series, which is about me cycling the length of the planet. It's called Cap to Cape, K-A-P-P to Cape. That's a four-part series of me cycling the planet, getting malaria, and it's also a very personal journey. So maybe if someone really want to get their career off the ground and perhaps thinking of taking on an adventure as a career, is something to watch. And that has a book to come with it. It's called Cap to Cape Again. That's also, you can buy it off Amazon or Stanford, maybe. That's a better place to buy the book.
Cool. Okay. I guess we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for sitting down with me.
Of course. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. For more information, visit theadventurepodcast.co.uk. The podcast is hosted by Matt Pycroft and produced and distributed by Pip Saunders and Alex Hall, and edited by Kate Bullivant. You can keep in touch at info@theadventurepodcast.co.uk and stay up to date on Instagram @theadventurepodcast.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.